Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm delighted to be joined today, pushing through. I'm delighted to be joined today by Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Hey, Joe Devine.
JJ Bull the Bullard.
Hello.
Okay, fine. Now listen, there's loads to get through today. Argentina, Australia, USA, the Netherlands. We're going to talk about those. There's a few other bits as well. And also we're going to be joined by Chris Camrani, probably for the last time, because I guess we only ever invite him on to talk about the US, although he seems to be good at talking about other things as well.
Yeah, there we go.
England play Senegal tomorrow. Probably talk about that a little bit too. And of course, points are bad later. Have you had a nice day, JJ?
I had a lovely, wonderful day.
Yeah?
Yes. What did we do? We had Nando's.
We did have Nando's. I had my first ever Nando's.
Yeah, I really like Nando's a lot.
Yeah, I thought it was fine.
This is not a paid section of the show.
Yeah. If it was, I wouldn't have said it was fine.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's but no, do you know what's better than fine?
Is it The Athletic?
It's The Athletic. Visit theathletic.com/TIFO, theathletic.com/TIFO, where you can find such wonderful things as Seb Stafford-Bloor, what have you been reading recently?
Hey, so this morning I read Felipe Cardenas' piece about Uruguay. So he went down to the Uruguayan hotel after their exit yesterday against Ghana and spoke to a couple of the Uruguayan players about what happened after the game. So there was some shenanigans. The VAR monitor got kicked over. A FIFA official seemed to get elbowed in the head at some point.
I missed all of this. We didn't talk about it last night.
No, not really, because it kind of emerged after the fact. And Felipe's done a wonderful job in recording it and talking to people. And that is a very, very angry squad heading home to Uruguay. But well worth your...
What's the name of the author again?
Felipe Cardenas.
And what's the piece called?
I don't know what the title is, but it's basically, if you search him by author, you will come across it.
You'll find it.
It's the head of the kind of Uruguay department on the website at the moment.
Wow. So, yeah. Okay, cool. There we go. Well, fantastic. That sounds like a really good piece to read. So visit theathletic.com/TIFO to avail yourselves of a deal where I think you can get The Athletic for £1 a month for 6 months.
Sounds like a great deal, that, Joe.
Lovely job. Yeah. Lovely job. But for now, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of who else? Lionel Messi? Yes, Argentina. What's the score?
3-1.
2.
Did they get it? No, it was 2-1. 3-1 the other game.
Okay. It was 2. The other game was 3.
There we go. Yes, Argentina 2-1 Australia. Now, JJ, how did this performance, this Argentina performance, how did this compare to the others so far in the tournament? Because we were expecting them to win, I think, if we're being realistic. But 2-1, a little tighter than perhaps we would have thought.
Well, I think they've got steadily better throughout the tournament because they started off badly against Saudi Arabia. That wasn't good. And then they've had to change the system a couple of times with different players in, get ones to work in different ways. John did a very good video on TIFO IRL, which came out this morning, about some of the changes that Argentina have made over the last few games.
It's his contention that tactically they're the team that seem to have changed the most. And that might be because of the injury to a couple of players, right?
I think injuries and just getting players in different positions. Basically, they lack a lot of pace and width. They don't have any real speed or wide players. Di Maria counts as one, but you know he's only good about 23% randomly all the time.
He's also, is he 35 years old?
He's old.
He's older.
Well, younger than... It's funny that's old, but...
Well, old matter. For a footballer.
Football years, he's old. And so in this game, so what they've done is change it to more of like a diamond. So they're playing Messi as more of a 10, but he is trying to get involved a lot more in games than he was in the first one. He's dropping quite deep to try and get on the ball and dictate things. And it's good because turns out he's amazing and is doing all these bits and pieces that are just making us watch the screen going, oh, and all that sort of noises that you get.
There was a moment during this game, Seb, and you said you might have been overreacting a little bit where you accused Argentina of being nothing without Messi.
Yeah, I wanted Australia to win and I was a bit gutted that they didn't. And I think I took it out on Argentina.
Sure.
What I will say is Messi was fabulous tonight and there are good parts of this team. I do think they're getting better incrementally with each game. There are just aspects of it which don't quite convince me. Like, I'm not hugely convinced by Otamendi Romero as a centre-back pairing. Mm. There's some mistakes there. And I mean, we watched Lautaro Martinez's struggles in front of goal. He started the tournament as a first choice forward. He looks bereft of confidence now. I think this evening it needed that performance from Messi to get past Australia. And whilst I'm sure they still will improve, it's not it's not quite what I was expecting to see from a team with their record coming into the tournament.
They're very functional.
But I was wrong about the Messi thing. That was over emotional nonsense. But yeah.
They're very functional, but they're built around making the most of Messi, and he is good enough to win the whole thing on his own. This is the point. It kind of makes sense to have just a really solid group of like attack dogs that can go and break things up and be really slow. And they played, the game was really slow, but it was slow because Australia made it that way. They made it really boring. The first half was so dull, just sitting a 4-4-2, showing the ball wide, and then Argentina don't really have wide players, the ball comes inside and they have to work it around. Sure enough, a little moment of magic from Messi inside the box just to go past someone and taps it in the goal like it's like a putt.
I mean, he did that in, was it the second game or the first game? His goal, did he score against Saudi Arabia? That goal where it was maybe one of the ones from outside the box or just inside, but it was against Mexico. Yeah. It was so efficient. It was like on the floor the whole way. There was nothing flashy about it.
He punched it up into the kind of just to the edge of the D and then fired at the bottom.
It was exactly the way to score that goal.
It's because he's tuned in to the frequencies of the earth. He just knows exactly how to play football and where the best thing to do and how to do it. Like he knows what to do, but can also execute it. All his attributes are set to 99, so it always goes. There's no like random number generators that can make him miss these things. It just always goes in.
Well, let me ask you a question about Argentina then.
Okay.
Lots of the other major teams at the tournament, we've had this conversation before, have coaches who play a style of football that we might now call tournament football, or we might think of when we compare it to domestic football leagues, a bit more regressive or conservative, a bit more stodgy. When we think about Argentina, we think about all of their flair attackers. We think about Lionel Messi and all of the collection of incredible players that surrounds him. And presumably, without knowing much about the team, a casual fan as I am, I would expect that they would play football with flair and with finesse and with aggression and some of the most attractive stuff at the tournament. Am I unfairly, am I sort of looking for an unfair expectation, I suppose, in the same way that I wouldn't expect England with, again, lots of players who can be flashy and attacking to play because I know how Gareth Southgate plays, or the same with France, or the same with Germany, for example. Like, is the same idea of tournament football being applied to this Argentina team? Do I need to readdress my expectations?
I think they looked really good in build up to the tournament. And when I watched a lot of them in pre-tournament research, they looked just genuinely good and no one could beat them. They had a massive long unbeaten run. It's like 35 games, something like that. And the players they have, like I'm saying, when they're functional, they're not particularly amazing at any one thing. Obviously, there's Messi. Alvarez is a good kind of all-rounder, didn't even start the game. They've got players, the players they can bring on, they're not hugely quick. They're capable of doing flashy things, but they don't tend to do it. So they kind of numb that down a little bit to make sure that they're not, I wonder if it's tournament style football where they're trying to not give the ball away so they don't have to chase it. That could be one of the things. That could be a tactical decision.
A Croatia type thing.
I think more like the England type thing where they don't want to give the ball away or they don't want to put too many players forward because then they leave themselves open. But you can see the problem, the reverse with that is that when you're trying to break down a team like Australia who are really solid and in this big block and you can't get through, is then that's when you need players who can up the tempo a little bit. And it's not about just being always fast or always slow. It's about being able to change the tempo and change, like take control of the game and move it how you want to. And that's what players like Messi can do. Very few players in the world can do it on their own. But they don't really have players they can bring on to try something. They can't really put players who can get in behind a high line, which is probably fine because they're not going to be against many of them. If they end up playing Brazil eventually, they get past the Netherlands and get to the final or whatever, and it's Brazil. Or they've been in the semis, doesn't matter. Then they'll have options to get in behind higher lines, so then you can see what they can really do. But it is very much like Seb sort of saying, the whole thing is built around being solid, which is good in a tournament because you don't lose. The idea in a tournament is you set up not to lose other than to win. And then you can rely on players like Messi and Alvarez and I don't know, other ones to create something in certain times. There's nothing hugely special about them, but there doesn't need to be.
Julian Alvarez, JJ just mentioned this, have you scored another goal? I think that's his second for the tournament so far. He's emerging, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. The trouble for Alvarez really up until this point, domestically at least, is he's arrived at Manchester City, really played quite well, but he's playing in Erling Haaland's shadow, and the entire conversation around Manchester City in terms of what's different this season, what they could achieve, is all about Haaland's form and his goal scoring range. And Alvarez is I don't know if you'd really call him a number nine. we were talking to Carl Anker earlier, and he came into the office to watch the game with us, and he sort of compared him to a young Edson Cavani, which interested me. And if Carl says that, then I believe him. But then I think you're seeing his worth, because Messi, there's that dependence on Messi, and there's that need for him to do things. But over the course of what Argentina hope is 7 games in just under a month, you can't have a 35-year-old responsible for everything, right? You need an Alvarez, you need someone who takes responsibility. Also, we've kind of touched on this with the Di Maria conversation earlier. Like, there's a lot of age in that Argentinian forward line. And one of the only players that can make runs behind the defense is Alvarez. Papu Gomez is very much a left to right player. He wants to play, sort of in front of the penalty box. He wants to cut him from a wing and create. He is also in his mid 30s, so he's not going to run beyond. And Martinez, that doesn't look a very healthy situation at all. There was that miss earlier in the game. People who remember the first leg of that famous Liverpool 4-Barcelona game recall at the end of the first leg, the pass that was set up Ousmane Dembele to potentially make it 4-0 to Barcelona, that he just shanked high and wide over the bar, looking like a player that had absolutely no self-belief. And that's kind of worrying, because Martinez is another guy who potentially can go beyond the last line, as he did unsuccessfully with the offside flag going up against Saudi Arabia in the first game. So if they're without him, you're going to need Alvarez, because he's really the only one that can penetrate in that way. So yeah, he's going to be very, very important going forward.
Okay. Australia, was there anything else that they could have done differently, Seb?
I really don't think so, Joe. I think if I was Australian tonight, I'd be extremely proud of what my team had done across these 4 games. To emerge from a group which included Tunisia, France, and Denmark was an achievement in itself. And I know that people will say they haven't been the most attractive side to watch, but I don't think there was another approach to progress. And a couple of themes that we've already touched on, but which were relevant again tonight. I thought Aaron Moy was absolutely excellent. So is Harry Suter. I thought Jackson Irvine was brilliant. And I think the team functioned as a unit extremely well. A couple of mistakes. The Matt Ryan moment was unfortunate, but I suppose what you'd say is credit Rodrigo de Paul for pressing him and creating the error, forcing it. But listen, I think what I take from this is, if you look at the impact that this run has had, I've seen pictures on Twitter and video from Australia showing fans celebrate. Also, I was listening to the Totally Football Show a couple of nights ago, and they had Samantha Lewis on, who is an Australian journalist who was reporting from, the press box a couple of minutes after the Danish game finished. And it's a lovely interview if you can find it, because you can really hear in Samantha's commentary what it means to see that group of players do well. That's a really lovely thing. And I think the way to assess performance for teams in Australia's bracket is, right, when you give this kind of performance and a World Cup ends, how has it touched people? Will, for instance, when the next generation of kids who sort of emerge in Australia, okay, so most of them are going to want to be the next Tom Trbojevic or, a Latrell Mitchell, fine, or they want to be, opening the batting during the Boxing Day test, or they want to be playing AFL. That will never probably change in Australia. At the same time, if a couple of those now want to be playing for the Socceroos at the next World Cup, that is a victory, because that's how you assess these things. They're not going to go and win a World Cup. The style is unimportant. It's how you connect with the country that you're representing. That is actually what matters. And also, look, style points in World Cup, nonsense. Like, how many France games has anybody enjoyed under Didier Deschamps in any of the tournaments? Like, very successful, but maybe 2 or 3 have been kind of free-flowing and shown, like, every player at the kind of the full extent of their ability. This is a great success. And I'm gutted for them, actually, because I think it's been a really welcome story in this. I think we've talked about bigger issues. We mentioned this quite a few times, but to have these little moments, which are sporting, is very, very important. And every one of those players, I think, comes out with their reputation enhanced. Like I think, like Mitchell Duke, for instance, showing what a good target man he can be. Like Harry Suter, we've spoken about a lot, but I think it amazes me that you can have such a serious injury. You can play, I think we worked it out, 1 championship game in preparation for a World Cup, and you can face the caliber of opposition that Australia have done, and you come out looking like a really, really good centre-half. That is a huge achievement. Like, yeah. Those of us who are not professional athletes, which is all of us, like, it's very, very hard to imagine, like, the recovery period and how important it is when you suffer like a problem like that, how important it is to get your confidence back, to get your rhythm back, to have trust in whatever you've hurt again. So a World Cup against Mbappe and Griezmann and tonight Messi and Alvarez. I mean, that's some pretty heroic stuff.
Sure.
So very, very sad for them, but extremely well done. I mean, it's just it's a great credit to that group of players, what they've been able to achieve.
Yeah.
And I hope hope when they get back to Australia or when the individual players get the chance to go back there, they're treated accordingly.
That's nice. JJ, Seb appears to have come to love Australia deeply. Have you ever loved anything in the same way?
As much as Seb loves Australia.
Mm.
I don't know if I have, Joe.
No?
I think that's the most love anyone can have for a country.
Do you think he'd enjoy a visit to Australia?
I'd love to go and watch an Origin Test series. Like, I'm a big NRL fan.
Origin?
Yeah, so Origin is...
Is that the beginning of cricket or...?
No, so that's an annual test series in rugby league between players who come from New South Wales and Queensland, and they play each other.
And
it's a three-game series. It's my favorite sporting event.
Why is it called Origin?
Because it's state of origin. What is your state of origin, Joe? Oh, I come from New South Wales, so I'm going to play for New South Wales.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm one of those people that gets up very early to watch NRL games on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Right. You're one of those people.
I'm one of those people.
Extraordinary amount of sport, don't you?
I do.
It's quite interesting. You've married someone who's also into sport.
Yes.
So that you can not only maintain but share your love of sport.
Yes, indeed.
With your partner.
Yeah.
Cats. And now he's staying with you and you love sport even more than he does.
Well, don't I just.
I can't tear him away from the sport.
He loves the sport.
Sometimes I'll say, oh, you know, let's go to the office now. And he'd be like, no, I just want to watch a little bit more table tennis.
Sport, yeah.
Yeah. Now, listen, in sad news, we've had to abandon Chris Kamrani. I did tell him. I didn't leave him.
How great has Chris been during the tournament, though?
He's great.
What a contribution.
And we will get him back before the end of the tournament. I want to hear his take on the US. But technical difficulties are what they are. So that's fine. But let's talk instead about Argentina facing the Netherlands in the next round, JJ. I asked the live chat just before we got going who they think will win. It's 61-39. Who do you think they've gone in favour of?
I might guess Netherlands now.
It's actually Argentina. 61% believe that Argentina will win that game. Yeah. Can you see why they think that?
Messi.
Yeah, I can. So the thing with Netherlands is that they're very clever tactically, Netherlands. We'll cover them in a bit when we talk about that game. And they will know the weaknesses that Argentina have. And the weaknesses are kind of obvious. They've got no wide players, like we keep saying. So you can just funnel everything through the middle and then block them. The difference that Argentina have is Messi, because even though you're trying to block everything through the middle, he can still make things happen. It has to go his way for it to work. So you can't rely on it, but it's not a bad strategy to go through that with him. And I genuinely think he is good enough to make Argentina win the World Cup on his own, basically. And you look through the team, right? So Martinez is a really good goalkeeper. I think Romero is a very good centre back. Otamendi, I know we're not entirely sure, but leader, he's a lot of experience there. And Martinez came on later on, he was decent as well. But this is your spine. So you've got, I'll say Romero, not Otamendi, right? I really like Enzo Fernandez. He's a really good player. He's made their build up much, much better, dropping in the hole to be able to then spread the play out and, you know, make them better from the back. Fullbacks are decent enough. Acuña is a quite high rated left back. He plays in Spain, doesn't he? I can't remember who, for Villarreal or Valencia. I think it's Valencia, maybe.
He plays for Seville, doesn't he?
I've got that all wrong. Anyway, I know he plays for someone in Spain.
Look it up while you're doing this.
Yes. And then Molina, fine. But DePaul basically serves as like a ball-winning midfielder to help Messi whenever he goes. He tends to be quite close to him and then can help win the ball back if he loses it. Alvarez is a good forward. Messi's a great player. It's a solid spine. And the rest of the players are very functional. McAllister's quite a good player. DePaul, like, they're just ball-winning midfielders who can play a little bit, even if DePaul was intent on giving the ball away in the last few games that they played. But I can see why people would think they'd beat Netherlands, because they are good.
Because they're Argentina.
Yeah.
And they've got Messi.
It's just and then you think about tournaments when teams who win it, like, the best players tend to be part of... Well, actually, I went through a bunch of, do you win the World Cup if you have the Ballon d'Or winner or the, what do you call them? The Golden Ball winner?
Yeah.
What it is?
Yeah, yeah.
Golden Ball.
Yeah.
And what actually happens is that you finish second. If you have the best player, you finish second. So like Messi was golden ball when he finished second against Germany. I forget all the other examples, but he always finished second. So
okay.
The live chat want us to talk about The live chat want us to talk about Matthijs de Ligt.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So there was an interview, there's a David Ornstein article in which there's some Matthijs de Ligt quotes in which he talks about not playing as much of a role in the Dutch team as he might have hoped under Louis van Gaal. And he's seemingly fine with it. He's not rocking the boat. He said, I didn't really expect to. And, you know, it's all okay. There was nothing particularly controversial about it. But it is a strange one. I remember saying to JJ earlier, I'm not the biggest Nathan Aké fan, but I think he's played really well. Mm-hmm. Virgil van Dijk is Virgil van Dijk. He's obviously going to start. I guess the kind of, De Ligt to me, and he has, after a little bit of a ropey start, he's actually started to play quite well for Bayern Munich in the Bundesliga. I still see him as a kind of a project player. Clearly, he's going to become like just an outstanding defender, and he's been like in that category probably since the kind of the run with Ajax in 2019. But there is still a mistake in him, I think. And there's something clearly that Van Gaal likes about the Aké Van Dijk partnership. Okay. And that's kind of fine. And like, I don't know, like I'm not worked up about it, basically. No. I guess it's kind of it's balanced. It looks fine. I've kind of been impressed by, actually the real story in that Dutch defense is probably the goalkeeper. Because I remember thinking when we were told that he was going to make his debut in the first group game, I remember thinking that's a hell of an ask for a player that's never really been exposed to like really top level football. So international football, Champions League football, like games of real consequence where you have a massive amount of pressure, especially on that position. I think he's been really good. He's 6'8", which really, really helps, I guess. Like that's pretty good quality in a goalkeeper. But I think if you go back, he hasn't made many outstanding saves. But he seems to be a very kind of efficient goalkeeper. Makes the saves he's supposed to, and there's minimum fuss. He's pretty good with his feet. That at the moment, that looks like one of the calls of the tournament by Van Gaal. Because if that goes wrong, can you imagine the criticism? Like, just of like taking a goalkeeper who has nothing other than Eredivisie experience saying, you're going to play in the World Cup now.
It seems like quite a Van Gaal thing to do.
He did the Tim Krul thing, obviously, back in 2014 against Costa Rica.
I don't even mean necessarily just specifically with goalkeepers. I just mean like belligerently, and that has negative connotations that it shouldn't necessarily. Conviction. But yeah, with conviction, making a choice that other people might not be able to recognize, and not. He seems to be someone that doesn't require other people's recognition in order for him to make the choice.
This is one of the things that comes up in that documentary I spoke about a couple of days ago with Van Gaal, because he talks about his reputation as being someone that can be quite brash and can seem quite arrogant. The way he explains it seems to be that I have conviction. When I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I have conviction in what I believe, and fair enough. He's won a lot. He's been very successful. I have to say, I really warmed to Van Gaal during that documentary. He's a kind of interesting, idiosyncratic person.
He is a human being.
He is. I do recommend people watch it. It's very, very good.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, I've been thrown by my boss sending me a message with a strange YouTube video in it. Right. Can't understand why he sent me that. Right. Do you think it's a creative way of sacking me?
Do you think he's got some sort of interpretive dance, maybe, or like he's singing something?
Well, it's like a 2-minute long music video with da, 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 and ends with "You're fired."
You're fired. I hope so.
Would it make you feel happier if JJ and I spoke? You took some time to actually watch it.
No, I'll watch it later because I love my job so much. I'd love to do this bit either that is the end. Yeah. But anyway, speaking of the end, let's have the end of the first part, now we'll have the beginning of the first break.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Ah, what a lovely break all the way through to the end. Now, let us discuss the other game that occurred a little bit earlier on today. US A1-3 Netherlands. Now, there we go. We know it's the Netherlands that will be meeting Argentina in the quarterfinals. I was thinking of asking Chris what the reaction has been like in the US, but let's talk about that when we speak to him next time. And instead, JJ, I will come to you for some tactical observations on the Dutch, por favor.
The Dutch clearly watched all the USA's games. I mean, all the teams have watched the other team's games.
Do you think so?
Yes.
Yeah.
They have staff just to do that even.
I think if we've done that,
I think that, yeah.
The football team's
probably
have.
They've definitely done more.
Yeah. They've probably watched them a few times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Do you know, I've always thought, like, it sounds glamorous to be a football analyst, doesn't it? But then basically you lose me at, like, having to watch the game again, just a second time.
Yeah.
I'm gone.
Well, the second time is actually the time I get all the best stuff for
sure.
The videos.
No, I don't care.
Yeah. But then after that, if you're watching it like five or six times, I mean, there's too much football to watch. And if you're an analyst, you hate it because you'd be watching nothing but football and football.
Although,
and football.
Weirdly, the ones I know are obsessed. They seem to enjoy it. Maybe I think doing anything, like, I think even, you know, I love The Wire, for example. And I have rewatched The Wire, but I wouldn't rewatch it each episode again immediately after I'd finished watching it.
Yeah, I have done that for The Simpsons series 3-9 and The Office and It's Always Sunny.
Immediately after finishing.
I do them in a loop.
So, yeah, that's fine. You go through I don't mean finishing a whole series and coming back to the beginning. I mean watching episode 1, season 3, and then watching that again.
Well, interestingly, when I was writing my cartoon that I did on YouTube, I watched several episodes of The Simpsons over and again to beat them out, to work out where all the jokes were. So basically analysing it the same way with a football game. So
incredible that you've managed to turn this into a plug, isn't it?
Yeah.
You really are a talented professional.
I'm just born to be a showman.
Yeah. Now showman us how the Dutch team
all
play.
Right. So what my point was trying to make here was that the USA play in a very obvious, clear way and done a video on this, which is coming up on TIFO IRL. It's already out. You can watch it after this when you're whatever you're doing. So what they do, I'll show people who are watching this on the live stream how they do it. So they have fullbacks that get high and wide, and then they have players like Pulisic and Timothy Weah who come inside the pitch, but they often start wide. Like wide right is Weah and wide left is Pulisic. They've got a striker. Ferreira played against Netherlands. He was rubbish. But then they've also got these midfielders, McKennie and Musa, that'll be around. And they also play wide. So they get loads of overloads in wide areas. So you'll get McKennie often plays as the widest player. Musa might be the widest player. It helps drive the ball from deep. Then you get Robinson as well on the left and Dest maybe on the right. And he might underlap or overlap. He underlapped quite a lot tonight. And so then what you get is like a 3v2 in wide areas. So if you have, say, Daley Blind and Nathan Ake and De Jong might come across, it's a 3v3. With these players over on the side. And that gives you options of moving it around and being able to rotate players. And that's what they do. Now, at the base of it, very important, is Tyler Adams, who plays for Leeds. Very good player. Bit of a ball winner, but he's also crucial to how the USA build play and how they go through from defence to attack through the midfield, basically. So if they're building out from the back, I don't know where the ball has gone, but imagine the ball is here.
It's with Tim Weah.
It's with Tim Weah. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. There we go. Say they're playing from the back, USA. Zimmerman and Tim Ream, they can pass to Adams in the middle. He might then try and carry it a bit and then distribute the ball to take USA forwards. But he has to stay at the base of this kind of triangle between Dest, or between McKennie and Musa, because he's the anchor for everything. And so what the Netherlands did was mark him. So they put a man marker. They had David Klaassen marking him the entire time. And then they had Memphis and Gakpo sitting just off of Ream and Zimmerman when they had the ball. So they were trying to encourage them to put the ball probably into these midfield sections so they could push up and win it really quickly and then counterattack with players like Gakpo, Memphis, Denzel Dumfries, and maybe De Jong or Klaassen or someone like that would join in. And that's what they were doing. And they were able to stop the USA play the way they want to. So they couldn't build the way they wanted to, which meant they couldn't get the ball through to players like Pulisic, which meant Pulisic was not at all involved in the game, couldn't get in it. And that's why USA looked so kind of... what's the word?
Restricted.
Null? That's not a word. Restricted, yeah. They weren't quite the same. I don't know, what I'm saying.
They look a bit fearful with the ball to me. Like, I thought once they got it kind of beyond the halfway line...
It's because they had no options, though. Yeah. That's the thing, because the way that the Netherlands were defending, or the way that their team shape was built, there was nowhere for them to go.
Yeah.
So they couldn't just play, and it was all built to then launch themselves forward on the counterattack. And it's... Well, another thing they were doing is really clever at, like, corners... or any attacks they had, was they were getting someone like, in fact, the last goal, right? So Robinson is marking, I think it's Gakpo, at the back post. So the most dangerous player in that situation is Gakpo or Memphis, and they go either side and they tie themselves to the fullback. And that means that the other side wingback can just creep up behind them and score. Yeah. And so what you got in this game, well, the last goal was, I think, a pass from Blind straight over to Dumfries. And he scored with basically a free shot, which is closer to the box, like that. So that's one of the things we're doing. So another thing they'd clearly worked on, because they identified it in the USA. What else did they do that was good? Those are all the things they did.
I felt like the first two goals were really crisp, really nice bits of football. But I think you'd be pretty disappointed if you were a USA fan, just because there are avoidable elements in all of it, like the failure to track. In the first goal for Memphis, he doesn't really, if you watch it back now, he doesn't really break into a sprint at any point. He jogs kind of at a decent pace away from his marker. I think it's Tyler Adams, and he just walks into a position of space in the penalty box.
But there's reasons for that. It's because it's tactical from the Netherlands. So the reason they've done that and drawn them out is so they can have passing options. Like you said, they look a bit scared in possession because they don't have any passes on. They got to do everything through lines. The only time they really got through was Adams took the ball in the half turn, turned past his marker and managed to play it in, and then they went. And that's how they managed to create a shot earlier on. But apart from that, they were getting locked down, couldn't do anything. So when they were opened up, the USA, the ball turns over. I can't remember who wins it, but the ball turns over and then they just go. So then you get these players all rushing forward, Gakpo, Klaassen, I think it might be Daron joins in as well, and they chase forward. So what you end up having is all these players charge into the box, go absolutely nuts and go forward. The USA, they retreat really quickly as they get back into their shapes, fast as they can. They run back, and as they're running back, they've had the ball for a long time, so they're a bit tired and they're jogging. Some of them are chasing back a little bit, and that's when Memphis he doesn't chase all the way, he falls to the back. So everyone's getting back into their position. This back line is actually in the right position, but these guys just aren't quick enough to get back in, and that's where the goal comes from. So it's more like, I think, maybe a bit of energy, and
that close into the game. Even that early in the game, though, like it just, like I understand it. Just there's something about it which looks wrong in the sense of it happens almost in slow motion, because we were watching it and you could see it opening and you could see the danger probably 3 or 4 seconds before it occurred, and there was no. It's kind of goal you expect a side to maybe concede after 75 minutes, you know, when like you have been like running for an entire game or you're kind of chasing a situation.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, also maybe the second Dutch goal is even more disappointing, because it's a cross which really should be cut out, or there should be a bit more pressure on the ball. Maybe that's old school thinking from me. Like when I was learning to play football, like that was kind of the mentality. Cross coming in, someone needs to get out and block it, or someone needs to put pressure on the cross.
It's McKennie. He was on him. He was quite tight to him, but just didn't manage to stop it. And I guess that happens sometimes.
Yeah,
you just
I guess.
Can't stop it.
It was more
that then Blind was floating again on the blind side of the last man, because they did that thing. I think all of this, all the goals and the entire game was won tactically. This is an example of a game, and it's not a lot of times when you can say a game's won tactically. It's generally to do with energy, input, determination, and then the tactics are about 20% of it, something like that, and skill might set it sometimes. Okay. But this was all tactical, and I think like Blind being spare for the goal, that was planned. They knew he'd be spare to get in to score by going to the blind side of a defender. The not running back fast enough maybe is true, but then they're maybe not just fast enough to get back.
Maybe.
Like they're running, but they're not lightning fast going back, and maybe they're not intense enough. Also, maybe they weren't warned about what they were going to do, that Depay would drop deep.
Sure,
maybe.
Sure. I was pretty surprised that, I mean, it's hindsight, and I talked about this a bit on Twitter. I was really surprised not to see Jordan Pefok in the US squad for this very reason. So like Pefok scored quite a few goals for Young Boys in Switzerland last season, moved to Union Berlin ahead of this year. And when Union were riding high at the top of the Bundesliga, he was kind of integral to that. He's got a really good partnership with Geraldo Becker. He's probably one of the quickest forwards in Europe. And he's kind of, he's not a prolific scorer, or hasn't been so far yet in Germany, but he's as close, in my opinion, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, but he's as close to the US have at the moment to having an all-round forward, which, I don't know, there's so little presence at the top of the pitch. It feels like one of the ways of skirting the issue of not having any options is, okay, it might be a little bit reductive, but having that direct option at the top of the pitch, someone big and physical, like Pefok is 6'3", and I've stood next to him in a mix zone. He is absolutely, you know, he's built, and he's a skillful player. He's good in the air. He's good with the ball at his feet too. He's like I'm not trying to make him out to be a world beater, but he's a very good option in the context of what else the United States have. And I just, I don't know. Perhaps people want to explain that omission to me because it was weird. And I haven't seen anything from it in this tournament which suggests that that was the right call.
Mm.
And also, I mean, should we talk about the US over the next 4 years ahead of 2026?
No, I was going to ask you. I mean, you know, with 2026 in mind, what are your thoughts?
Well, I like what I've seen from the US in this tournament. I think there's a lot of positives. I think they are not, they're just a good football team now. And some of the kind of the snobbery and the sneering that, American soccer teams have experienced in the past is completely out of place. What I will say, though, is there are a few holes and there are a few sort of positions which need to be stocked ahead of that. So I looked at I went back through the kind of the World Cup since 1990 and found that the United States have scored, I think, 28 goals in those tournaments. And that's eight different tournaments. But also their top scorers in history are Clint Dempsey and Landon Donovan, who are both tied on 57 goals. And of the two, Dempsey has a slightly better ratio of 0.4 of a goal per game. And this is what the US need. It's what a lot of other teams need. I'm not trying to say that you can just find goal scorers everywhere, because a lot of teams are looking for them. A lot of countries have trouble creating that kind of player because it kind of went out of fashion. Germany, one of them, we've talked about that.
Mm.
But if the United States had a regular goal scorer, someone they could depend on, like, because Dempsey was a great player, I don't really think of Dempsey as a center forward. Donovan was a great player, but he was kind of an all-round forward. He was very hardworking. He was very skillful. You could play him out wide as well, as Everton did when he was in the Premier League. If they could find that player, then I think it wouldn't necessarily mean that they could win this kind of game, but it would mean that mistakes made in this kind of game, like the ones that we've talked about for the first and second goal and the third, because that's not a good goal to concede either. You make the margin for error a little bit broader, because if you've got goals, you can get away with things. Whereas this was they didn't play that badly. They just, it was just a brutal exposing of like some of the inefficiencies at the back and a little bit of naivety here and there and maybe a bit of fatigue. I don't know. But with goals, you could, single game expected goals is a little bit of a false science, but I think they're about 2.07 or something today, which kind of, given that their one goal came from just a really bizarre sort of passage of play where I don't even know how to describe it, the kind of the flick that sort of goes wrong but loops up over the goalkeeper and goes in. Mm. There were more goals in this game and there were chances and they didn't take them. Whether they'd have deserved to have gone to extra time or won, that's not what I'm saying, but goals allow you to kind of get away with stuff, I think is what matters. And you hope that over the next 4 years, whether it's someone like Pepe, I don't know, I'm not wholly convinced by him from what I saw in the Bundesliga. Still very young, of course, but that's the player the US need to find. And hopefully they do, because in 2026, based on what we've seen this tournament, like the US should be going to that tournament as the strongest of the three host nations. Like, I don't think that's an unfair thing to say. Like,
it's interesting. I'm just noticing a comment in the chat from Lucas, who says this detail emerged in a conversation between a friend and Lucas. One potential issue is the fact that the US men's national team might not have that many competitive playing matches between here and 2026. That has been an issue in the past, right? Yeah, I mean, we talked about that with Canada earlier in the tournament, that it's not as frequent that they get to test themselves against, you know, the sort of opposition that they will then come up against in the World Cup.
It's tricky, but in terms of player development, I think the key there, the first step at least always, is making sure that young, you know, national team qualified players are having decent minutes in competitive leagues.
Yeah.
I think that's fairly consistent across the board.
Sure.
So that's the key to me. I don't think they have to be in Europe either, because I think MLS has changed. Demographically, it's changed enormously over the past sort of 10, 20 years. It's a very fast young league now. Mm. It's a producer of talent. It's a place where European clubs go to buy players rather than where they try to send the ones they want off the wage bill. That's kind of out of date assumptions. But they need to have these players playing as often as possible. So,
do you think it'll be Berhalter still in 2026? It's a long way away, right?
I wouldn't know, Joe. Like, I try and listen as much to US fans who tell me about Berhalter, but I wouldn't know. I don't know what his inefficiencies are. I don't pretend beyond the research I did ahead of the tournament, I don't pay enough attention really to have an opinion there. But 4 years is a long time.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll see. But yeah, no, happy to do some reading on that front.
Okay. Okay, cool. Actually, there's a couple more comments in the chat about the possibility of the United States participating in the Copa America. Qatar did that, didn't they, as an honorary invitee, as the hosters or the winners of the Asian Cup, the hosters of the next World Cup. I mean, that potentially could happen over the next 4 years, couldn't it? That would be interesting. But anyway, let's have another break now. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about England and a few other things, and we'll do points of bad. Yes, okay, lovely job. England play Senegal tomorrow. JJ, we are going to come to points of bad, but first I want to hear those thoughts of yours
about England versus Senegal.
Yeah,
I think that it will be a good time for all involved, particularly the football.
Right, yes, yes, yes.
I don't know, I think, to be honest, I think Senegal are all quite good, but England will play that sort of game where... Well, here's my thought, right? So England will play probably the 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3 shape that they've been doing recently, and they'll do the same thing. They don't send too many players forward, try and let Senegal take the game to them and try and pick them off or win through a penalty or a corner or something like that. Not make use of all the lovely players that they have, but that's how you win tournaments, so that's fine. And then Senegal are coming with a lot of, there's a good feeling about them going into it.
Sure.
And they have some decent players.
Champions already this year as well, right?
Yeah.
African
yeah.
champions.
I think they're genuinely a really good team.
Yeah.
And it might be...
It's just a shame they're missing out on Sadio Mane, but I mean, they've done so well so far without him.
Yeah, but then they've got players like Ismaïla Sarr has stepped up, and we talked about this before in previous live streams and things.
Illemin Ndiaye, like the Sheffield United player, he's had a really good season. I think
your laptop sounds like it's going to take off.
It does, doesn't it? I'm sorry about
What's
that.
What's happening to it?
It just needs renewing.
Do you need it open?
I don't, so maybe
I think he's playing Civ 6 in the background.
I look at the chat in the background.
I think he's playing Civ 6 in the background.
That does make it go like that, yeah.
Anyway, so Illemin Ndiaye for Sheffield United, I think he's got about 8 or 9 goals this season. And so what they have, there's no Sadio Mane, two really good wingers. You talked about Sarr already, like he's a problem for England. Yes, you're going to take that away. Okay. Ndiaye is someone to be really wary of as well, because he's an attacking winger. He's going to combine really well with Bilal Diaye, the centre forward that will start tomorrow. Senegal not to be taken lightly at all. I know that kind of the tendency for England fans in this situation is going, if we win 5-0, it's not going to be a nervy, difficult game. And no one should get distracted by the fact that Mane isn't there, because I think we talked a lot during this tournament about like how conservative some of the football is and how important a lot of teams see it to not concede goals. Now, Senegal take in a world-class centre-back and a world-class goalkeeper into tomorrow's game. They are a very, very good team. They're African champions for a good reason. Like Mane had a good tournament, but no one should think that Mane was the only reason they became African champions. That's not really fair. One thing I say, Ali,
he's just a star.
He's a wonderful player, and no doubt they'd be a lot stronger with him. But they are still a very good team, and that is not that's not a comfortable game for England. That would be very, very close.
Yeah. And what I think could happen, England should win. To be clear, I think England are probably the better team, and they should win. But if they come into it playing the same way we've come used to watching them in, where they're slow and they're trying to take it seriously and play tournament football, and they just don't score for a long time, and suddenly Senegal gets a bit of luck, or they just make something happen because they can, and then suddenly England are chasing. I don't know if they can step up the level. I don't know if they can then take the tempo up if it's too late in the game.
Well, speaking of stepping up a level, we talked about this earlier, and I can't remember if we mentioned this or not yesterday. Perhaps we did, but... hypothetically, were England to make it to the final, they have an extraordinary run.
We were talking about this on the way in.
Which I'm sure has been replicated in previous World Cup tournaments. I cannot think of such a difficult run. They play Senegal now, champions of Africa. They would play France, presumably. We assume if France beat Poland in the quarterfinals, we assume they would then play again, extrapolating Spain, which would be a very, very difficult game in the semi-finals. And then they would play, presumably, if all favourites go through, one of Argentina or Brazil in the final. And all of those teams, with the possible exception of Senegal, although I don't want to discredit them, could win the whole World Cup.
Yep.
In a very straightforward way. And we wouldn't be too surprised if any of them did. Now, when you compare that to England's run during the Euros last year and the World Cup in 2018, where they saw very good results and a very good finishing position, that's a bit different, isn't it? And this was the criticism of many of the detractors of England's performances over the last 4 years, were easy runs. It was something that was said a lot, I suppose. So if they do make it far in this tournament, I mean, they will have earned it.
They will. It might be a conversation for about a week's time because I'm yet to be convinced. Like I still, from an English perspective, I still feel like France would be a bridge too far.
Oh, I'm not saying they will make it far. I'm just saying hypothetically, if they did,
Would have to be one of the kind of the most impressive knockout runs in World Cup history for them to do that. Yeah,
I can't think of another team that had such a and played every one of the favourites on the way. I mean, I'm certain that there have been. I can't think of them off the top of my head, but a little look earlier at the most recent World Cups, France had a fairly difficult run in 2018, but it wasn't like this.
I think the France team in 98 beat Paraguay, Italy on penalties.
Mm.
Luigi Di Baggio missing, hitting the bar. Cannot remember who else they played, but I remember the Brazilians had a really tough set of games against the Dutch, that one that went to extra time. But yeah, it would be, I can't think of it when it's been stacked, not only just against sort of traditionally strong teams, but actual favourites of the tournament. It's kind of a real-time assessment of what these teams are good at. But yeah, that would be extremely tricky, I'd have thought.
Someone in the chat saying Italy 2006, ? I can't remember. We were also saying earlier, that's the tournament that we remember the least about.
The only game I really remember is probably the win over Germany in the semi-final with the Pirlo pass and the Fabio Grosso goal.
Yeah.
You know, the one right at the end of extra time where he steps in, curls it into the far post. And then there was the kind of the Del Piero clincher.
So they played in the group stages. They had Ghana,
they played the USA,
and the Czech Republic.
Yeah.
Then they had Australia, Ukraine, Germany, and France. So I don't think that's
well. The difficult. Australia game actually in that tournament was really difficult. So it took a very very late.
Italy had two red cards in this World Cup.
Yeah. Well, they
there was a red card in four of their seven games.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. I think Daniele De Rossi got sent off in 2006 and then took a Francesco Totti penalty in about the 140th minute to win it. And it was a very dubious penalty decision too. But that was a very difficult game against Australia. And then obviously, penalties against France. So that was a bit of a grind, but they were a very defensive team, Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Fabio Cannavaro won the Ballon d'Or that year.
Yes.
So that's kind of a measure of what was important in that side.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm trying to find out for some other teams, but I'm struggling a little bit. So I guess we should move on. Fine. Maybe we'll do that before another
Shall
podcast.
Shall we do a points are bad?
Let's do a points are bad. Yes, why not? Are we okay to have a little points are bad music and the old let's pop the headphones on and have a listen. Points are bad. They're really, really bad. Points are good.
Do your Dublin voice.
That's your Dublin voice right there. Look at that. Well, there we go. Points are bad. Thanks again to Ben Summers for sending in that lovely version.
That is very lovely, that version.
Ah, bad. Now listen, a drama occurred during this live stream. And I have to tell you, Henry Cook, TiVo employee, is a hero. Yeah? Because I had to raise his flatmate, John McKenzie, to make his predictions. I entered the live stream tonight knowing John hadn't done that yet. He hasn't failed to yet. He did, as you remember, he had his first and final reminder, and I tried to give it to him straight. He didn't take it. He wasn't on his phone, yeah? I tried to tell the live chat to tweet him. Lots of people did. He has since complained to me that his Twitter is now a mess, but he didn't see that, yeah? I tried to contact one of our friends who he plays video games with to see if he was on a Discord channel playing video games, ignoring his phone. He wasn't there. Nathan, editor Nathan, did offer to make the predictions for him, but I said, that'd be breaking the rules, Nathan. That'd be breaking the rules, yeah?
Where was he?
So I text Henry, who lives in John's house. I bet he was in the bath. It's the only place he didn't take his phone. And Henry screamed up the stairs. Make your predictions. Points are bad. Straight on the phone. Yeah. No thanks or anything. I went to the extreme lengths to remind him. And all he did was complain that his Twitter is a mess. That's it. That's your final reminder, John McKenzie. No more reminders. Who'd have thought of it? You'd expect it from him because, you know, sort of, it's part of his personality. You know, forgetfulness is part of his personality. But yeah. John is very, you know, he's got surgical precision, John. It's
a very sharp mind, John McKenzie. Yeah,
surgically precise in forgetting to do his job.
Yes.
Right, okay. Anyway, also he lost today, so he is going to go first, which is useful because he only sent me one score. For each game. You go last today. So hopefully you don't take any of John's.
Okay.
That would be difficult, okay. Wouldn't it? Because I told him he was last. So if he wasn't, then would the
it
penalty apply?
It would help
apply?
If we knew sure what happened would today, because then we would understand the order.
Yes, you're last.
Okay.
You gained 6 points today. You picked up 3 points on both games.
Yeah.
Because your predictions, Seb, were a 1-0 to the USA and a 0-0 to Argentina, Australia.
Not a good day.
And that was a bad day.
Yeah.
JJ, John and me all picked up 4 points.
Okay.
So we're all joint together. And of course, John will go first of us because he's currently
but
in last place.
Why am I not going first?
You are going first.
You said last.
You're in last place.
No, but I go first.
Do you remember earlier when Seb had the headphones on and thought he could hear an echo, but what he could hear was saying something outside the room?
It wasn't even an echo. It wasn't even that.
You're last in the game today. Yeah. You pick first as a result of that.
I know, but you said pick first.
Oh, no.
I want to pick first.
You are picking first. Okay. You are picking first. Oh, God. Can I get a taxi home with this man later? Oh, I'll give him a piece of my mind, JJ. Don't you worry about it. Now, listen, the games tomorrow, Seb Stafford-Bloor, begin with France-Poland.
Very, very interesting.
But some of the chat think Poland, by the way.
Yeah, I do not agree with them. I will say 2-0 to France.
You think 2-0 to France. That's fine, because John McKenzie didn't say that. Okay. John McKenzie said 3-0 to France. Fine. I will be going next. And I think 3-1. Yeah, not 31. Oh, no. 3-1 to France. JJ Bull, what do you got?
2-1 to France.
2-1 to France. Okay, fine. Now, Seb Stafford-Bloor, England-Senegal is the other game.
I will take a conservative 1-0 to England.
Well, I think that's probably quite a good shout, isn't it? John is just one-upping you each time. He says 2-0 here. Okay. I am going to say 5-0. And what do you think, JJ Bull?
5-0.
I just say 5-0 every time.
So I'm trying to have some entertainment for myself, but then what do I really think versus what...
Listen, Seb Stafford-Bloor is currently still winning overall, so you do need to...
Need to be bold. Go with the 5-0 Senegal. That's what your heart says.
It's going to be a low score. It's going to be a low scoring game.
All right, it's going to be low scoring, but it'd be funny if it was England 1.
Senegal are going to score a goal in this game. By the way, nobody hit. Yeah, you want to say that?
Yeah. Let's do it.
I think remember now, we aren't predicting results. We're predicting how many goals each team is going to score.
Important distinction,
right? Which is a different thing.
I'm predicting the result.
You're the only person who's predicted a goal for Senegal. Personally, I think that's terrible. I think they will score.
I think it'll be 1-1. I think there'll be no penalties, but I'm going to say 2-1.
I can change it to 1-1 if you want.
No, I want
2-1. You want 2-1. Okay, fine. Now, the grand totals at the end of day 14. In last place is John McKenzie on 114 points.
Get back in the bath.
In second to last place is me on 113 points. And tied in first place.
Oh,
edgy.
It's Seb Stafford-Bloor and JJ Bull on 108 points.
That's good.
Yes.
Well done, sir.
I've stopped trying as much
Right.
Because with anything, it's good, fun at the start.
It's a really weird thing to say, isn't it?
Don't want to win.
It's such a weird thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah. What happened is that I'll regret.
Hold on. This is very revealing about our personalities here, because I told you you were tying and Seb said, well done, sir, as if to say, well, in a solidarity, you know, in a world of solidarity,
not trying anymore.
Of unity, we're all good friends here. Congratulations. And you go, I'm actually not trying anymore. And that must be why Seb's on the same number of points as me. Because if you remember, I was winning the whole rest of the time.
Bad results, and then I was like, well, I'm bad at this as well, so I'll just stop doing it properly and have some fun with it. And now,
think about the impact that your words have on other people, you know? Look at his face.
He knows every result from football since forever.
I'm sad now.
He should be winning this easily.
First,
he's the most professional of all of us.
If it was appropriate to cheer him up, I'd ask you to do your goblin impression, but it's not appropriate.
I did goblin walking around.
Not now.
First, you take my computer away from me, then you take my happiness.
Yeah. Well, listen, and now I take your autonomy because the podcast is over and you'll be back tomorrow. Tomorrow is your last day before a break, I believe.
Going home to see my wife.
That's right. Hooray. Fine. But Seb will be here tomorrow. JJ, you're off tomorrow, but John McKenzie's back. And I'll also be here. Thank you today to producers Craig and Jamie. And thanks to editor Nathan. We'll be back tomorrow. I've already said that bit. Goodbye.